Welcome to Share a Pint, where we tap into the craft beer scene. I'm Jerry Holla, your host.
Today we're talking with Mark Osborne from Adroit Theory Brewing. Thanks for being on the show, Mark.
Hi, thanks for inviting me. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a beautiful place. We'll take some shots to show our listeners later, but you've got a new front tap room up here. What kind of brought about the change from where you were in the back to where you are now?
Well, it was a long and drawn-out process. There were some other tenants that were in here, and we eventually were able to scare them off because so many of our customers assumed that the front door on the front side of the building was, in fact, our front door, which it was not. It was their business. Mm-hmm. So eventually we scared them off, and we were able to take over this space, which we greatly appreciated the extra square footage. But the real driver was twofold. One is, while you know, most of our customers love the industrial grungy feel of our tasting room that we started with, it wasn't air conditioned, it wasn't heated, and particularly in the summer, it was just miserable from a customer perspective. And once we moved into this space, which is heated and air conditioned, and we have a lot more seating, we found that people stayed a lot longer, and that's good for business.
Absolutely.
Second thing was, is we are definitely growing, we're expanding, we're getting ready to set new tanks, new equipment, in where basically the bar used to be. So I think customers that have been to that space wouldn't even recognize it here in, you know, in a couple of months, and we'll be able to, you know, increase the amount of beer we're making as well as the frequency of some of our releases.
Right. And again, people that are not used to that and are like, oh, I really liked that back in that grunge area. Once they find out that you're expanding and you're able to produce more, I'm sure they're going to be, well, it's a fair trade-off to go to the front tap room now that they've got more space to make more beer.
Exactly. And better sound system.
There you go. You have a very unique way of naming your beers. Some have subcategories in brackets, followed by another subcategory in parentheses. Some have either brackets or parentheses. Some don't have either. Tell us about the approach.
So I knew from day one that we didn't want to do what everybody else was doing, which most people, you know, they, you know, this is my, you know, my, some corny beer pun named beer that, you know, was self-explanatory what it was. We wanted to come up with, you know, names that dovetailed with the artwork, which is very dark and somewhat mysterious, as well as the idea of things taking like an arcing story type approach, where we might release beers over the course of a year versus just sequentially. And the names, once you could step back and look at it from a big picture perspective, would all make sense. We got a little carried away on some of the ideas, but the idea was that, you know, it wasn't going to be an easy to understand, easy to comprehend thing at first glance. But the more you looked at it, the more you thought about it, and the more you kind of saw the other pieces of the puzzle, that it would make sense in a big picture perspective, as well as, you know, sound cool. We wanted them to be like their own album, if you will. And some of the bands that we like do that type of you know, naming sequence, like with our ghost numbers and things of that nature.
Well, that's like I said, that's the number one question I get asked when I came a year ago and kind of really first saw this place. The one that I got was the antithesis, the Blue Kamikaze cocktail variant, and I really, really, really enjoyed that one. And so I took a bottle of it and I sent it to all the guys at Untappd that I know, Tim Mather and Kyle Roderick. And at the time, they were doing the Drinking Socially podcast.
They've
got some
that.
New guys that are running it now since Tim has moved on. But you know, when they had it, that was one of the things that Kyle was like, "It's like its own cinematic universe." I have to know, you know, why they do that.
Well, I appreciate, first of all, I appreciate you doing that. I remember that podcast come out, and I was like, "How did these people get my beer?" And you know, because it's always after the fact, you always kind of wish you could like preface it by saying, okay, so when it comes out of the bottle and it's like neon blue, don't panic. But no, that actually worked out real well, so thank you for doing
you're
that
welcome.
But yeah, and I mean, that was the idea. Like, we wanted people to be confused. We wanted people, like, the day they walked in, you know, in 2014, that the first beer we ever made was BAYS, but it had slashes in it, and people were like, not only do I don't even know what this is, I don't even know how to say it. Know, I want to order the BAYS. Like, oh, you want the bays? No, we want the Black as Your Soul. Yes, that's what I would like. That's the beer I would like. You mean Ghost One? Yes.
Nice.
So it was a whole, you know, concept. And it does make it a little tricky. Untappd is very good for that. Matter of fact, the easiest way to find our beers is to key in the ghost number versus the name. But they're all there. Every single beer we've ever made, including every variant or subcategory or any other way that we slice and dice things. We used to use a trifecta system. We we ditched that the first year. But the rest of the things we still do, and we do try to keep it up to date.
That's good, yeah. We also, and you talked about it a little bit, you have amazing, extremely detailed, themed artwork on your cans and bottles. Who does your artwork, and kind of describe for our listeners your unique look and your approach?
Sure, so the number one, well, not the number one, but a question we get asked quite often is, you know, who does our art? And the answer is, well, it depends which one you're looking at. We use, or we work with, I think right now we're working with 8 or 9 designers. Oh. All across not just the country but the globe, mm-hmm. Most of whom I've never met other than electronically. And it's all about finding the right person for the right job. So, you know, different ones specialize in different looks, mm-hmm. and depending on what the concept is, I'll try to find the right person. And ideally, I like working with the same people when I can, but to try to find the person that can execute what my vision is, because mm-hmm. I'm always the one kind of driving that train. But we do spend quite a bit of time. We spend as much time thinking about the outside of the can or the mm-hmm. bottle as we do as what's on the inside of the can or mm-hmm. bottle. And again, not to, you know, focus too much on that, because obviously at the end of the day, it's, you know, the beer is the beer, and, you know, it has to be executed at a very high caliber. But I wanted it to look like a piece of art. Like, mm-hmm. like when I was a kid, like when you'd go to the record store and you'd buy an album, and, you know, you buy with your eyes, if you've never had it before, exactly. You'd pick up that, and you're like, wow, this looks awesome. And then you'd go home, and it was a gatefold cover, and you're like, wow. And then it had the lyrics, and then you'd pull out the sleeve, and you're like, wow. That's what I'm trying to do with our beers, you know, mm-hmm. that it's cool, that you can sit and enjoy a beer, but you can also look at the artwork and find all the hidden images. And sometimes mm-hmm. we'll put Easter eggs,
oh, cool.
You know, in the art, or try to make reference to future things that haven't come out yet, oh. so that, you know, so people can play along at home.
That's awesome. What's that timeline like for you? Like, how far out do you have to start planning to, you know, get your vision across to the artists and have them give you some things conceptually? You know?
So in an ideal world, you know, you would have an infinite amount of time to do these things. But as you can imagine, the confines of what we're doing, particularly given that, you know, we're dropping, you know, 100 beers a year that are in package,
wow.
You know, it becomes a little bit of a like, well, we don't have any more time for this. We got to get the show on the road.
Yeah.
But from, you know, concept to it's in your hand, 6 weeks would be a long time.
Okay.
Like we've done them in 3 or 4 weeks. Okay. But the ones that are usually the most epic, you spend a little bit more time on them. But so I was trying to do the best I can within the confines.
Okay. Well, in addition to your naming style and the artwork, many of your beers have suggested pairings for food, cheese, cigars. Tell us how that came about and why that level of detail is important to you.
So it's funny, the ones that don't have pairings on them are mm-hmm. usually the ones where the design is so awesome
okay.
that you don't want to allocate any real estate, you know, to that area. You're like, damn. But we try to do it on all of them, and I would say, you know, 90%+ of them do have that on there. You know, I'm a foodie at heart. Mm-hmm. We do trend to attract people that are into those, you know, more delicacies, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important. I mean, I think the right food or the right cheese or the right cigar mm-hmm. with the right beer will not only make the food or the cheese or the cigar better, but it'll make the beer better. Because mm-hmm. it's all about, you know, compliments and things that just dovetail together, you know, beautifully. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about those things when I'm designing beers with my brewers, as well as some of the ones that I've done myself,
mm-hmm.
Of, you know, like what experience do we want to put forth in terms of, you know, the whole concept. So you're looking at the art, you're thinking about the music, you know, you're obviously drinking the product, but you're doing it in the right order with the right things to enhance that experience, which mm-hmm. food and cheese is a no-brainer. Some people particularly who aren't cigar smokers, sometimes don't realize, but that, you know, smoke can be a, you know, natural flavor enhancer, and it really can be an epic pairing if done properly.
Absolutely. And that was one of the things that kind of jumped out to me is how I spent some time in the cigar industry and learned a lot more about that and came a finer appreciation of that when I was there. And so that kind of jumped out that I was like, wait a minute, you don't see that very often. You don't see people taking that kind of time and thought to do exactly what you said. It's an experience. You know, when you put all those things together, the drinking of the beer, the conversation, what you're eating, you know, the cigar, all of that can just be, hey, I'm just going to sit down for a couple hours and enjoy a good cigar and a good beer. And, you know, and so that really stood out to me as being, again, a level of detail that you don't see very often with places and clearly well thought out. So I was like,
they are legit pairings. They stand behind every single one of those pairings. They are legit.
That is good. It's funny, you get some people that expand their palate, you know, they're drinking some beer and they're like, hey, I am a cigar person, but I haven't had that cigar, or maybe I'm not used to that style, and they may give it a try.
We have seen a lot of people do that. Mm-hmm. And again, obviously, sometimes people will bust our chops about it, which, as long as they do it cleverly, I don't mind. Mm-hmm. I had one guy who was like, well, he was reading the label. You could see him on Twitter, and he's like, well, I don't have any duck confit, but I do have some pork belly that I could pair for them. I was like, there you go. See, I mean, you know, it's all about the idea. But they're legit pairings. Matter of fact, we've met a lot of the cigar people we've met in the cigar industry because we've used their cigars for pairings. And same thing with cheese, the Beehive cheese people. I thought they were going to be mad at me, but they were tickled pink that we had, you know, paired one of our beers with their cheese. And they sent us this crate of cheese, which was greatly appreciated. Yeah. So. Yeah, it works out good.
That's great. Well, you touched on it. You are really actively engage your fan base through social media, probably more than any other brewery that I can think of off the top of my head. Why is that important to you, and how do you stay on top of that with everything else you have to do on a daily basis?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think we do as good a job. I look at other people. I think they do a great job. Yeah. I think we do kind of a mediocre job. But thank you. I try as best we can. You know, it always starts with, I think, beautiful pictures. You know, people buy with their eyes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I work with a team of photographers that, you know, shoot our stuff for us. And I do some of it myself. But, you know, you make it look cool and it engages people, particularly if it's something like our Blue Kamikaze or our Drank series or our Eggnog beers or some of these ridiculous things that we've done. But that just, people are like, what is that, you know, and that is, you know, what prompts the conversation. Mm-hmm. But I do all the social media myself, 100%. And, you know, so if you're corresponding with us on social media, chances are you're talking to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, it's just for us, you know, been good for getting our name out there. I think relative to how small we are, and again, we're not terribly small as we were at the beginning, but in the grand scheme of things, I mean, we're a pretty small brewery, but you can go to California, you can go to New York, you can go to Florida, and people who know who we are, which is difficult because, again, we also aren't one of those, you know, handful of hyped breweries that everyone knows who they are, you know, that just hit the magic jackpot. So for us, social media is a great way of, you know, building that brand and building the experience, because it's not just about IPA, it's about the culture, the lifestyle, the look, the aesthetic from day one. I mean, that was what we wanted was, you know, when you walked in the door, like, Droit Theory has a look and feel to, you know, their package, to their tap room, to the apparel, to the whole enchilada. And that's actually been one of the most challenging parts is when you do work with multiple people is to make it cohesive.
Yeah.
So that, you know, as soon as you look at it, you say, well, that looks like a Droit Theory. Yeah. And I think so far so good.
Yeah, no. I mean, again, clearly, like you said, we've touched on each of the various parts of the brand that you're putting together that fit together very nicely. For me, when I was thinking about the social media aspect, I think about how often I'll see that you interact with somebody who's had a comment or checked in about your beer or something like that. I mean, that was actually how we connected first is, you know, I kind of put that out there and you were like, hey, let's just do this. And there just doesn't seem to be enough people that are dialed in for that where you can have that fast of a turnaround. You know, where you can say, oh, I put this tweet out about such and such, and like the brewery responded, oh, that's great. No, the brewery responded within like 10 minutes or 20 minutes or 30 minutes, which is a pretty reasonable amount of time for you to even think that you're going to get a response. And it's like, hey, yeah, you like that, but did you try this or did you think about that? And it's just more than a retweet. You know, I feel like when I read yours that you're connecting back with your fan base and that it's important for them to know that you hear them and that they're out there and you appreciate them. And that's, to me, what comes across and why I feel like maybe your approach is a little bit more different than what I've seen other breweries do.
Oh, cool. Well, yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah. We do try.
So talk to us about Consume Life, Drink Art.
You mean our motto?
Yes.
Our slogan, our way
mantra,
of life?
However we want to call it. Yeah, exactly.
I think it's immensely clever.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it was funny. When we first started the company, you have an idea of what you want, right? Mm-hmm. But you don't know exactly what you want. So I had a crowd surfing, crowd sharing, something like that, mm-hmm. but where like multiple people kind of like chime in to, mm-hmm. Make something happen. And we had some contests and stuff in that format to help us write our manifesto, mm-hmm. write our slogan. And we had like 500 entries and, you know, you're whittling it down and trying to get feedback and finally getting it narrowed down. But somebody else, you know, came up with that slogan. And when it finally got whittled down to that catchphrase, CLDA, I mean, it's everything you need to know about Adroit Theory. You know what I mean? We have these long, obtuse names. Yes, you know, we do a bunch of ridiculous things. Yes, we do. But at the end of the day, consume life, drink art, I think summarizes everything that we do. You know, like, life is short. You have to live for today. You know, that goes very much in line with our, you know, more rebellious side of our brand. But the drink art aspect of it is that, you know, it's not just conceptual. It is physical art, but also liquid art. And mm-hmm. it just sounds badass.
Yeah, it fits there very well. Like you said, that every little piece of what you've done to brand and separate yourself is very clear and distinct, which is why when you go back to, you know, California or West Coast, other places that you wouldn't necessarily think that they would find your beers based on the size of your brewery, that's why. You know, because it's very clear that you spent a lot of time on every little piece of it, and you do have a very distinct, unique brand, which is exciting, as I don't know that that's necessarily the case as much anymore. That people put as much thought into that. And that's one of those things I think that not only just draws people to you, but keeps them loyal, you know?
We definitely have I think, done that in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, identifying who our customer is mm-hmm. and resonating with them. On the flip side, of course, is that not everybody's your customer, right? Whereas, mm-hmm. you know, it's beer, right? Like mm-hmm. 90% of people like beer. Mm-hmm. I mean, right, but high percentage, mm-hmm. and so, you know, you attract the general public, that's what we call them. Mm-hmm. But when the general public comes here, sometimes they're, you know, a little off-put because, you know, the heavy metal is blaring, and everybody's wearing black, and mm-hmm. the menu is this long mm-hmm. and exceedingly complicated, you know, and that's fine, but they're not our customer, you know what right. I mean? Like, we try to find who our customer is and, you know, resonate with them. Mm-hmm. And these people live all over the globe, not just here in Virginia.
Yeah, well, having those artists that you mentioned earlier across the country, I'm sure, also helps expand the brand because, you know, say, hey, I did that artwork for this, and have you heard of this American yeah. brewery called?
Well, some of them are real famous, like more famous than we are, right? So, yeah. like God Machine, who did our Demons Surround Me label, which is like the artwork that's coming out for our Dawn of a Dark Day. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's pretty famous, like in that dark art world, mm-hmm. and people coming, like when he did the first label for us, like people coming out of the woodwork, you know, like, oh, I want to buy that. I want to buy a poster of that. I want T-shirts of this. I want this, that, and the other thing. And I mean, a lot.
Wow.
A lot of people just because he dropped one little post about it, you know. Uh-huh. So it was good.
A good problem to have.
Good problem to have.
Well, oh, speaking of Dawn of a Dark Day, 6th, mm-hmm. Your 6th anniversary celebration is coming up on Saturday, mm-hmm. January 25th.
And, yep.
I'll be coming down.
Excellent. Excellent.
Tell our listeners what they can expect from this event and how they can attend.
So our 6th year anniversary is on January 25th, and that is almost to the day of when we opened, which was the third week of January in 2014. So we're very excited. This year's festivities will be very similar to last year's festivities in that we'll have a good-sized tent set up on the front side of our building, and we'll have outside bar out there as well as inside in our new tasting room. We're obviously breaking out lots of beers just for that event. It culminates with a Willett bourbon barrel aged version of Demons Surround Me, which is like the biggest stout we've made to date. Mm-hmm. And then it's the first time we've ever done it where it's like just a flat price for unlimited samples. Mm-hmm. So it's a very economical way, even though, I mean, you know, it's a little bit of money, but relative just walking in and sampling, you know, 5 or 6 of our beers, you're going to spend more doing that than just buying a ticket to come to this event. Mm-hmm. Plus, you have the opportunity to buy that rare barrel bottle. Plus, we have a bunch of other stuff that we'll be releasing. Then the event culminates mm-hmm. After the beer festival in a metal concert here in our what used to be our front parking lot with 4 bands that we're very excited about seeing and listening to playing, and again with an unlimited sampling scenario where you get to go to the concert, all you can sample and drink. Yeah, should be pretty exciting.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, tell us where people can find you online, through Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that.
Yep. So Adroit Theory, same handle for all the platforms. Very important. People planning to start breweries, get the same handle across all your platforms. I mean, we do Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter are the three platforms that we support very actively every single day. And then our website, but Untappd is another one that is 100% up to date. Like, you can check the menu, and, you know, within a few hours of something kicking, I mean, it's reflected on Untappd. Every single beer we've ever made, including every other variant, is there and up to date. So those are the platforms.
We'll put that up on our website at sherrypintpodcast.com. We've learned about the brewery. Now let's get to know you a little bit better, Mark. Tell us about your role here.
Obviously, we're a small company, and so I wear lots and lots and lots of hats.
Mm-hmm.
I've taken the first 4 years that we were in business, I was definitely completely focused on sales and marketing and a little bit on production, but, you know, maybe like, you know, 5% of my day was spent doing that. 2 years ago, I decided to become more involved in the production side of the business, and I still do a lot of the sales and marketing and distribution type stuff, but I've taken a much more active role in that. And I think, you know, the focus of our beers, I think, has shifted definitely from about 2017 onward. I mean, I think, you know, even, you know, our worst beers were still, I think, good, but I think they've, particularly since 2017, gotten, you know, better, like release after release after release after release. And I think, you know, things are definitely humming along at a, you know, a very high level. And I think having a more hands-on approach to what we're doing. So, like, you know, I do all of the adjuncting projects. I do all of the fruited goes projects and all those types of things. Those are all my little babies that I'm mm-hmm. working on. I take a very active role in, you know, IPA development. I work very closely with my brewers. At the end of the day, that's their job, and I want to make sure I give them the right tools to make the best beer they're capable of. But I do find that having a big picture view, as well as jumping in when I need to get into the weeds, has really improved, I think, our product overall, and in terms of the scope of our portfolio, because that was definitely a big goal starting in 2017. From 2014 to 2017, we basically made like one type of beer, and that was big and boozy beers, and that's all fine and dandy. And people definitely seem to like that. But, you know, I wanted to be able to have a wider portfolio. I'm still not trying to make every style on the planet, but I wanted to be able to have people come here or to buy our products and have something light and easy drinking. So, you know, we started with a Kolsch, then we moved on to a Pilsner, and, you know, we're getting ready to brew a Helles and brew a Doppelbock and, you know, have a bunch more like classic style beers. And then our IPA game, frankly, was extremely weak from 2014 to 2017. Starting in 2017, we made a respectable IPA, and it's, we've worked very hard, and it's gotten better and better and better. Again, we're still not an IPA, or that's all they do, right? But they're solid. And of course, we've always made, you know, big and boozy. That's always been in our wheelhouse. And what we've added is these very, you know, dessert forward, you know, a little bit sweeter, a little bit, you know, more going on malt forward beers. And then of course, the fruited fun stuff, which sometimes we get a little carried away, but, you know, that was definitely been something I wanted to do, where it's just fun, easy drinking beers that taste like summer. They taste like a tropical cocktail you would drink on a cruise ship. You don't even know you're drinking beer. That's something I wanted to be able to emulate, and I think we're executing that at an extremely, extremely high level.
Oh yeah, the illusion of safety. It's I probably had about seven different variants of it, and every single one of them has been really just delightful. So yeah.
Well, at Dawn of a Dark Day, we're going to have a dragon fruit version with a bunch of other stuff, but dragon fruit's the driver, so it's like neon purple.
Okay.
And my personal favorite is we make one with calamansi fruit. And it's, I think...
And what style of fruit is that? I've seen it a couple of times that you've used it in some beers, but I...
We have. So it's basically a fruit from the Philippines. It's basically a sour orange. So it's a hybrid style fruit, but it's tart and tangy, yet familiar, yet foreign. It's the best fruit ever.
Cool.
And we do one with mango and passion fruit and lemonade, because, like, we're all about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it is... Get in my mouth, delicious.
Nice. Well, how did you get into the craft beer industry?
By drinking beer.
Okay.
I mean, I love beer. I mean, you know, just like everybody else, I suppose. You know, you go to college, you drink terrible beer, you get a little bit more money, and you spring for, you know, something that isn't, you know, $2.99. but there I went to I went and did a studies abroad program in England, and so I drank cask beer, and it's like, whoa, what is this, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I got back stateside, and you know, you have the gateway beers, you know, like the Fat Tires, mm-hmm. and the, you know,
Sierra Nevada,
Sam Adams, yeah. And you're like, oh yeah, more and more and more, and then you know, this isn't even that long ago, maybe 12 years ago. My wife, who also loves beer, and her family, who loves beer, we went and visited Stout's Brewery up in Adamstown, PA, yeah. And had a great time, met the owners, and they gave Ed Stout gave me this hour-long lecture about drinking, that I should only drink beer that was made within 30 miles of my house, and it has to be fresh, local beer, preferably German-themed, but it has to be fresh and local. And so he got me excited about it, and after that meeting, we have an RV, we decided to start traveling around, we visited, you know, hundreds of breweries, went to brewery festivals, went on beer cruises, there's a real thing.
Wow.
Really fun. But anyway, so, I mean, just head first, you know, mm-hmm. went down that rabbit hole and just having a great, great old time, and not an expert, but I was, you know, becoming pretty knowledgeable, and I saw 40 on the horizon, and I'm like, uh-oh. I was like, what should I, you know? I enjoyed what I was doing, my other job, mm-hmm. But it wasn't a job, but I had another business, but it wasn't like as satisfying as I wanted it to be. So I was like, what do I like? I like beer. So this was in Virginia when there was only like 20 breweries. Mm-hmm. And the 20 breweries are fine breweries, but I mean, they were all basically making, you know, this is my pale ale, this is my brown ale. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you know, I wanted something exciting, something adventurous, something that was not being done in Virginia. There were some places, you know, like Three Floyds, they were doing cutting edge stuff. There's a place mm-hmm. in California doing cutting edge stuff. Nobody in Virginia was pushing the envelope. So I decided, it was 2011, and I was like, I had to start educating myself, learning as much as I could about the process, and started the brewery and hired my brewer and basically off to the races. And, you know, a lot of it we've kind of invented as we've gone along. Versus, you know, I came from some other, you know, brewing industry job. You know, mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we kind of invented our own path.
That's great. I even saw where, you know, Brian, your head brewer, kind of saw how he got associated with you, and I thought that was kind of a very interesting thing of, you know, brewing at home on my own, and then the next thing I know, I see this YouTube video, and then I kind of start coming in and sharing some of my beers, and they're like, hey, those are pretty good. Why don't you brew with us? And just his evolution into the process, I thought was very interesting and very natural as far as how you feel this brand is. And when you look at this brewery, you know, like it fits, like you would expect that's how he would come into it.
Well, and that's the truth. My original brewer, Greg, who worked for me for 3 years and was a great guy, he was a home brewer.
Uh-huh.
This was his first professional job. Mm-hmm. And I purposely wanted to hire somebody who hadn't been classically trained or who had worked at a big, you know, brewery, you know, that knew all the process. And now, again, in hindsight, mm-hmm. you know, perhaps I would have, you know, done it a little differently.
Yeah.
But it worked for us in terms of creativity, in mm-hmm. terms of like just doing crazy things that nobody else had done. And it was probably because, you know, they probably learned, don't do that, you know, like in brewing school, do not do that.
Yeah.
But you know, we did it, and it worked. People liked it. It got us known. It got us a big enough fan base. And again, you know, at this stage in the game, you know, I have, you know, other people that work for me that, you know, have been gone through the process and know a lot about making beer from a technical perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think we're making, with the exception of some of our, you know, crazy things, you know, technically well-made beers. But yeah, I think getting started, I think it was very important to have people that were not inside the box. They were outside the box, and that's how they thought about it. So when we would sit down and think about beers, it was, you know, like basically reverse engineering food, or like, how do we add food to this? Mm-hmm. Or like, what can we do to enhance the whole experience? And I think that creative thought process is important to have somebody that, you know, doesn't have, you know, blinders on.
No, I think that's a great point. And as you're telling the story, that's what I thought about, is just people thinking outside the box. I've kind of been homebrewing for about a year on my own, and I just know the same type of thing. You're more likely to quote-unquote break some rules because you don't really know, and you're going to experiment because you're working with smaller batches, and you can go, wow, that really turned out, or holy cow, don't ever do that again. But yeah, I would think that someone who was a little more traditionally trained might be less willing to experiment. So it's interesting that, you know, you bring somebody in who goes, I don't really have any rules other than I just wanted to try this, and wow, that was great, or wow, we won't do that again.
No, I think there's like, we love German style beers, you know what I mean? Like we brewed a Kolsch, we brewed a Pilsner, and like we thought long and hard, and they're not perfect, but they will eventually be perfect. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a reason that Germans didn't invent hazy IPAs. They didn't invent pastry stouts. They didn't invent these, you know, fruit bombs, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there's tradition, and then there's like experimentation and creativity, and I think that's what Americans excel at in general, but particularly when you're, you know, not confined by the traditional process, you can think of really creative ways to solve problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what have been some of your biggest challenges?
For us, you know, kind of keeping up with growth without getting too ahead of ourselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been a lot of breweries that have gone from, you know, the size we were, size we maybe currently are, to here in like a year or two. And that's just crazy. It's just, I mean, don't get me wrong, I think it's good for them, but it just, we didn't want to do that. We want to do everything, you know, small steps, one step at a time, incrementally, and fund ourselves, do it all through our own pocket versus, you know, borrowing a bunch of money and having some beautiful tasting room. Like when you come here, it's a very modest and, you know, humble place, but, you know, we paid for this. So we're not in debt up to our eyeballs, you know, and it allows you to have that flexibility. So for us, you know, even the way we've set up our new tanks is all the ideas about thinking like, how can we be flexible? How can I brew 2 kegs of beer? Because that's how we started. Like, we would brew literally 2 kegs of beer at a time. Mm. And it's still having that flexibility to like, okay, we want to do a 20-barrel batch or something. That's all fine and dandy. But I also want to brew, you know, 10 barrels and split it off into 4 smaller batches and experiment and, you know, put boysenberry in this one and raspberries in this one and this hop in this one. And having that types of flexibility has been very, very important for us. So we do try to stay relatively small and relatively nimble to do that. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, we continue to grow, you know what I mean? So it becomes more challenging, you know, the bigger batches that you do.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you stay committed during some of those tough times?
Well, I sold my other business, which was good because it allowed me to free up time to focus 100% of my time and effort on this. And, you know, obviously that gets rid of any parachute that you might have, you know. Mm-hmm. So I got all my eggs in this basket. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think when I get excited when I see people, like when I go somewhere and I see somebody wearing our shirt, like not even in the state, you know, I go somewhere else or, you know, you see it. People drinking in Japan the other day. And I was just like, huh. That's very exciting and very motivating, you know what I mean, to make the best, most interesting thing we can, because it's not just these people I know that I see here at my tasting room. There's people all over the world drinking our beer and chiming in, you know. Yeah. That's very motivating. It's also very scary, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's, for me, very motivating, you know, like how do we make it that much more over the top?
What do you think contributed the most to your success?
Well, that's a tricky one. You know, because we have pioneered things a little bit differently. Like, I think the tasting room, you know, we're a little bit geographically challenged. You know, we are kind of in the boonies. You know, there's no public transportation. There's not very many people to live around here. So, you know, we had to make that work. But I think that, you know, has been good because people resonate with the brand, resonate with the lifestyle and the look and the feel. And the beer, I think, is, you know, on point. On the distribution side of things, I do think, you know, the strategy of very intense, very, you know, well-articulated artwork has worked well for us because we have lots of demand, not just across the country, but, you know, internationally as well. We've begun distributing in Europe. We're getting ready to start sending beer to Asia. We have a lot of things in the hopper. And again, it's because people see it online and they say, wow, you know, wow, that's, I need this in my life. I don't care how much it costs. Yeah. I don't care. Send it to me. So I think, you know, those decisions early on from a brand and from a marketing perspective, and again, backing it up with solid beer, you know, has worked well given that we wanted to expand the way we have versus, you know, some of the local breweries like Hardywood, for instance, that, you know, they didn't want to grow outside of Richmond until they had saturated Richmond, and then they expanded just a hair more, and then they made sure that was saturated. And a lot of people go with that model. We like more of a thin model where, you know, it's just here and there, but mm-hmm. it's more every, you know, a wider footprint.
Yeah.
And I'm glad we made that decision early on, because I think that's what's going to propel us to go from here to here, you know,
right.
like in the omnipolo type of sense of the word.
Gotcha. Well, once again, where can people find you online and get Dawn of a Dark Day 6 tickets?
Oh, well, you better hustle. Better hustle on that one. Yeah, the Dawn of a Dark Day on our website, which is simply adroit-theory.com. And if you just Google Adroit, you know, our Facebook has links, Twitter has links, Instagram has links. Obviously, Untappd is up to date. It's a really nice time to come out to Adroit. It will be a little crowded, but not crazy crowded, and you get to sample a wide variety of beers for basically a flat price. So I think it'll be a pretty fun time. But if they can't make it to that, the new tasting room is open for business, and we routinely have between 20 and 30 beers available at any given time, which is really quite a lot relative to what other people are doing, particularly given how small we are.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those are available to go in both bottles and cans, so it's very fun. Distribution has increased, although we're becoming a little bit pickier about where we, you know, put beer. But, you know, here in Virginia, you can buy it at Costco, you can buy it at Wegmans, buy it at Total Wine. We distribute in Maryland. We also distribute to 20 other states via Tavor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's relatively easy to get some of our stuff.
Great.
Albeit very small quantities. You got to hustle. You see it, you should buy it.
Well, we'll definitely, again, like I said, we'll put that up on our website at shareapintpodcast.com. Mark, I want to thank you for your time,
for
sharing a pint with me, and I'll see you on January 25th.
All right. Cheers.
Share a Pint is released bi-weekly on Friday mornings and can be found at shareapintpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at share_pint. Show notes for this episode are available at shareapintpodcast.com. Music for the show, Groundwork, provided by Kevin MacLeod, and can be found online at incompetech.com. Share a Pint is made possible by help from the Community Media Center of Carroll County. Associated with the craft beer industry and have an interesting story you'd like to share on a future episode? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at shareapintpodcast.com or email us at jerry@shareapintpodcast.com. Until the next time we share a pint, I'm Jerry Holla. Prost.